Welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, where modern portfolio theory can suck it. A student of the School of Graham and Doddsville and a clergy member of the Church of Warren Buffett, here's your host, Eric Schlein.
Hi, this is Eric Schlein. You are listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast. We have Marcelo Lima back on the show with us today. Welcome, Marcelo, back onto the show.
Hey, Eric. Thanks for having me back. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk about Facebook today. I thought your analysis was very interesting on Amazon. And why don't we just we'll go to another FANG stock? How about that? So we'll talk about Facebook if you're down.
Sure.
Okay. So you're also, I believe, a shareholder in Facebook.
Yes, we are.
Okay, yeah. When I say you, your firm. So tell us a little bit about, were you looking again? Were you looking at Facebook originally as a potential investment, or was it just another one of these like, oh, this seems like a great company, I should learn about it, regardless if I'll ever buy it or not? How did that research process start for you?
Yeah, I wish I had an intelligent sounding answer like that, but I don't.
Okay.
The answer is, I'll tell you, the reality is that when Facebook had its initial public offering in 2012, I took I was a very sort of cheapskate value investor, and I looked at the IPO filing and very, very quickly concluded this is overvalued because it was at a high multiple, right? Mm-hmm. So couldn't have done a more stupid analysis. I also thought, by the way, that this was a fad. I wasn't a believer in social media. I wasn't a believer that this was a real business that was going to last a long time. And by the way, I still am not entirely sure that that's the case, although I have higher confidence today than I did in 2012 that this is a real business and it will last.
Well, the elephant in the room with that is MySpace, right?
Yeah, so of course back then I remember being in school and there being a ton of alternatives. There was MySpace, there was Orkut, there was Friendster.
I remember Friendster, and it was always like the inferior MySpace that nobody used, right?
That's right. And it was extremely slow and the user experience was horrible. There is something else. You know, when Facebook did its IPO, most of the founders sold their stock. I think Dustin Moskovitz Dustin Moskovitz. He sold almost everything. I know Marc Andreessen sold, over $100 million of stock, if I'm not mistaken. And this is just in the early months after the IPO. So I think even the guys who were very close to the story didn't really realize sort of the rocket ship that they were sitting in.
Do you think Mark Zuckerberg realized it?
You know, I think if he did, he wouldn't have sold, right? Because there were still a lot of doubts back then. There was this whole issue with shifting from desktop to mobile. Mm-hmm. Which was a huge problem. So, just for context, and in second quarter of 2012, mobile revenues were 3%. Mobile advertising and desktop revenues were 97% of total revenues. And they did just an incredible pivot. So, by fourth quarter of 2017. Mobile advertising revenues went from 3% of total to 89%. And desktop fell from 97% all the way down to 11%. Now they don't even report desktop anymore because it's sort of like, who cares about desktop?
Interesting. So before I want to talk more about the business, I actually do want to go back to MySpace for a second because I think it's something that's interesting that I was thinking of, which is, people back then, I remember when MySpace was around, or I guess it's still around, I guess, I don't know who uses it anymore, but there was that argument that, well, MySpace will be around. You can't compete with MySpace. It hasn't, it has a network effect, and as it continues to grow rapidly, it makes it, harder and harder to compete. It was widely considered that MySpace had this almost like monopoly-like competitive moat in the same way that people make the argument that Facebook does today. So it's two questions. Number one is, what happened in your view? And number two, How is Facebook different?
So I don't feel, you know, super qualified to tell you about what happened to MySpace. I'll tell you what I recall reading about it. And this, there's an excellent book on the history of Facebook called The Facebook Effect. And it goes over a little bit of the MySpace story. And from what I recall, MySpace was, after it got sold, particularly, it was just very, very poorly managed. And it was a little bit of it was very disorganized. The product was all over the place. There was no curation. There was no identity. You could have, if I'm not mistaken, you could have sort of anonymous pages, and you could customize the page with whatever mess you wanted in music and all sorts of colors and bells and whistles and things like that. And it turned out that this was a time of experimentation. So there are all these competing companies, competing social media companies trying different things. And it turned out that at least in this case, less was more. So Facebook had a very simple and clean user interface. It had this emphasis on identity. So you sort of had to be who you were. You had to provide your name and your photo and all that. And of course, there are fake profiles on Facebook, and it's a recurring problem. But by and large, that was the premise. And it just turned out that Mark Zuckerberg and his team were a better steward of this idea, and it just won out at the end. But I don't think it was clear that was going to be the case.
And it also wasn't clunky. I remember MySpace. Yeah, I feel if MySpace had just stuck to its roots originally, it could have just become what Facebook has become, or, you know, a similar version. But I remember when it started, you know, you were able to add all those weird shit and little bells and widgets and things that just became obnoxious. And the page also got very slow, like very clunky and slow. I remember the user experience was horrible after a while.
Yeah. So, you know, absolutely.
It reminds me a little bit of Yahoo Finance. I don't know if you can relate, but when I was in high school, Yahoo Finance was my jam. Like, I just went to Yahoo Finance if I needed some quick numbers or to look something up quick. They had a very, you know, a decent stock screener. Like, you know, for something free, it was pretty damn good. And now if I try to go on Yahoo Finance in an age where computers are significantly faster than they were over 10 years ago, the website is way slower. It's way clunkier. It's harder to find the information you're looking for. It's not intuitive. And I'm just like, what the fuck happened? Like, all they had to do was do nothing, and it would have been a great website, and they had to screw it up.
Yeah, exactly. and it shows the importance of having a team that really cares. And
I know. All they'd have to do is bring someone like me in and be like, what the fuck is wrong with you guys? Like, you just go back to the way it was in 2005, and you'll have more users. I don't think I'm wrong about that either. That would take 30 seconds of advice, and I don't think it would be that hard to do. But clearly, I don't think I'm the only person in the world who feels that way.
Well, you've got this is a job interview, so maybe somebody will hire you after this podcast.
Yeah, can you imagine? Anyway, this isn't about Yahoo. That's a whole disaster in and of itself, that whole thing. But back to Facebook. So you were saying before I cut you off with that passionate rant about how much I cannot stand Yahoo Finance anymore.
Well, and what about Google Finance, right? That one
that sucks
totally
too.
Went down the drain. Yeah.
I never thought it was even above. I thought it started down the drain, and now it's only gone deeper. It was never in the sink to begin with.
I don't know what they were thinking, but they had a decent product, and they just completely destroyed it.
And you could have made, and with the power of Google, they could have made it so awesome. I mean, they could have literally made like a decent competitor to like a Bloomberg Capital IQ kind of thing, just with less data, and they decided not to do that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, that one still blows my mind as well.
So
let's go back to Facebook.
I think it was very tough to see this. You know, right. It sort of, there were a few visionaries. Somebody like you know, DST Global, they came in and they saw what was happening in Russia and around the world, and were able to buy hundreds of millions of dollars of Facebook stock just pre-IPO. You know, Yuri Milner leads that firm, and he was sort of a very much a visionary. But besides that,
Bill Miller, I think, got in right around the IPO too, I think.
Oh, he did?
I believe so.
Yeah.
And yeah, he's someone who you could say is a value guy who's always broken the mold with traditional value metrics.
That's right. He was also early in Google and Amazon, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct.
Yep.
And he was also, I remember years ago, he had prided himself on buying Dell computer at like 2,000 times earnings or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this, you know, and we can have a whole discussion on, sure, on earnings and P ratios, but he was definitely ahead of the curve in understanding that PE ratios were are perhaps becoming less effective as a metric.
Yeah, and I would say even more so price to book ratios.
Well, price to book ratios to me it never really made a lot of sense, because for the simple reason that if you have a company that buys back its stock, eventually it'll get to a situation where it has negative book value because of the way the accounting happens.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you get to a point where you just have negative equity. And so,
well, I think where I'm coming from, and I see what your point is, where I'm coming from this is, you know, if you look at, say, you know, just a basic commodity company or something that has no competitive advantage and has a lot of, you know, tangible assets, book value probably is somewhat of a decent measure of intrinsic value. Would you agree with me so far on that premise?
Well, yes.
If you have book value of X and you're just generally producing 6-9% return on equity every year, if you're buying at book value, you could expect you'll have like a 6-9% return over 20 years.
Okay, that's fair.
Right, fair. Okay, so as we've gotten more highly advanced technologically, we're seeing more and more companies like your Facebooks, like your Googles, like your Amazons, that take very, very little actual capital to produce wealth. Okay? Right? You're still with me, right?
Yep.
Okay. So if you say something that you're like, oh, bullshit, Eric, like just say that. So I want to make sure every premise you're aligned with. So
no, I agree.
This whole notion, I have heard, I'm not the first person to say this, but as you start seeing more of these companies that don't need as much capital to produce, to generate wealth, the whole notion of book value becomes more and more ridiculous. Like, you're never going to measure Google on, you know, its real estate or what the building is worth or what the metal in their servers are worth. Like, that's not where the value of Google is. So, and obviously, I think anyone listening to the show understands that. But I think what's interesting is I'm not convinced that we're ever going to go back to your basic economic averages, right? I think that because of technology, there are some things, like the fact that Facebook can do what it does, that Google can do what it does, with small amounts of capital, it's not like it's a startup anymore and it's just going to, you know, one day it's going to go back to the way companies were in 1900. I think that's a permanent thing. And it's made me wonder whether valuations just for the rest of eternity should be somewhat higher over time due to, you know, a lot of companies having just more stable, you know, higher returns on capital over time.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said.
You do? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So
not a lot of people don't when I say that to them.
Yeah, no, I think obviously I agree with you. I think a business that requires very little capital to grow and that is growing should be valued at a higher multiple. And to your point, if the economy is predominantly these types of businesses, or if we're at, let's just say that the S&P 500 is now dominated by these kinds of businesses, or let's take it a step further. Let's talk about software as a service companies that invest a lot of money to acquire customers on day one and get paid over time, and they have sort of de minimis earnings, and they trade at 100 times or 500 times or pick your number times earnings, because the number earnings really don't mean anything. Imagine that the entire S&P 500 was composed of those types of companies, right? Then you'd have all the fundamental, you know, Shiller cyclically adjusted PE ratio people saying, oh my God, you know, the market is going to collapse tomorrow because we're the S&P is trading at 500 or 1,000 times earnings. If you don't understand the process underlying those, what creates those accounting numbers in the first place, you can't really make an evaluation.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah. So it's interesting. So looking back at Facebook, which is clearly one of those companies, how are you, you know, when did you actually start investing in the company? Like, what had you actually start buying into Facebook?
You know, it to my stupid eyes of a cheapskate value investor, until recently it looked expensive, and you know, it's not something that attracted me very much. Over the past couple of years, I started thinking about it more and more, and really made an effort to understand it over a year ago. And what I realized is that it resembles very much the newspaper businesses that Warren Buffett was buying in and trying to buy in the 70s.
Explain that.
Well, so the premise of the newspaper business back then was that it was a local monopoly where you had this bundle of news and sports scores and stock prices and local news and global news, et cetera, and you couldn't get that information anywhere else. You also had pricing power, so you could sort of, if you had an attractive advertiser base, you could charge more for advertising, and it was essentially the definition of a consumer franchise. So Buffett defines a consumer franchise as a company that's needed and or loved by its customers. It has no close substitutes, and it has unregulated pricing. And the thinking back then was that these companies would grow about 6% a year, because it was sort of GDP growth plus inflation. And he even joked that if you had a dumb nephew, you would, you know, and you wanted to give him something to do, you would have him work at a newspaper because you couldn't screw it up.
Yeah.
So conceptually, if this is a if you think of the Washington Post, for example, which was a Buffett and holding for many, many years, as you know, it's you could think of that as sort of a toll booth on sort of the U.S. economy. And I say a toll booth because it has these very strong competitive advantages. And it's a toll booth on the economy because advertising revenues tend to be a fixed percentage or a fluctuating percentage of GDP, but they tend to grow with GDP over time. So as the country grows and you get more output, you tend to get more advertising dollars.
Right, that makes sense.
So now let's explode that, right, globally to billions of people around the world, and you have essentially what Facebook is.
Right. So walk me through this. So you see that, you can make that comparison, and when did you actually start getting interested in Facebook as an investment, besides just seeing it as a great company?
You know, it was about, I don't know, over a year ago at this point.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't remember exactly when. You know, it's these ideas are sort of seep into you slowly, and they bubble to the top, and you start thinking about these things in different ways. And it took me a while to understand, but once it got through my thick skull and I started really thinking of it this way, it made a lot of sense to me.
And how are you? How do you look at it valuation wise?
Well, you know, at this point, Facebook is a much easier story to understand, because it's not something like in the last episode we talked about Amazon, and that's a company that reinvests the vast majority of its cash flows on purpose. It almost generates no profits on purpose, right? Facebook is a company that from the very start had a lot of accounting profits and real cash flow profits to show for and very high margins. So it's a very different story. And even, you know, previously, before I looked at it, it had very high multiples, and it's, again, something that I should have understood, and I guess I would have understood with my new way of looking at things and learning how to underwrite growth. But let's just look at it today. It trades at a very, very reasonable multiple relative to the market for what I think is a substantially above average business with above average growth prospects.
So what would you say if you had to actually value what the business should be worth? Well, how would you look at that?
You know, I rarely look at things like that because okay. What I think, I think it's very tricky to say, oh, it's trading at X and it should be trading, it's worth Y, right? That's sort of, I used to do that a lot when I invested in a lot of, let's say, liquidating trusts, closed-end funds at a discount that were liquidating, or those sorts of situations where the sort of the upside was very capped.
Right.
But ideally, what I would like to do is find businesses that can create growth and intrinsic value and grow their intrinsic value over time by developing new businesses, by investing in R&D and growth and sustaining innovation over time.
Probably you and Charlie Munger would say the same.
Yeah. So Charlie's a great inspiration, right? So it's what I can tell you is I think that Facebook is valued very attractively right now relative to its competitive strengths and the quality of its balance sheet and the quality of its management, despite all the bad news. And perhaps, you know, the bad news, I think, is largely priced in, although you never know. Could the way things are going, it could always go lower.
You know, this is what's also interesting is if I was an analyst at Goldman Sachs, as opposed to not being that, I'd probably have a very hard time with your answer. You feel me on that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? It's like you just gave, you know, you're running a fund, right? You spend your, at least a lot of your time doing research and analysis. And you just gave an analysis on Facebook that didn't really specifically go into, well, I think it's going to be this growth rate in 10 years from now, and this is what it will look like, and I'm going to discount this by 10%. And, like, you know, all of these things. I mean, with Amazon, I think you had to do that a little bit. But, you know, I think for you, and tell me if I'm wrong, it's more like, okay, it's a pretty, like, reasonable multiple to free cash flow. They're producing lots of cash. They're still growing a lot. And, yes, this scandal may have hurt them temporarily, but they're doing the right things. They're investing in more security. They're keeping a good user experience, and you get this multiple of cash flow. So I'm going to buy it.
Well, that's true today. I'll tell you what I did initially.
Right.
So what I did initially,
I meant as it, like today, like if you're looking at Facebook right now.
Yeah. So, you know, we've owned it for a while. And so that's the answer I gave you today. But I'll tell you, initially, when I looked at it, I did a much more granular analysis. What I did was I said, OK, I have all the sort of the population, the monthly active users for Facebook by geography. So Asia, rest of world, Europe and North America. Mm-hmm. And then I have the average revenue per user in each of those regions. And that And you multiply those numbers and you get the revenues. So how much can the population grow in each – when I say population, I'm talking about the Facebook population.
Right.
How much can the number of users grow in each of those regions? And, for example, North America, it's barely growing at all, right? North America
is pretty saturated. Yeah.
Right. Asia is still growing. Rest of the world is still growing. And then you have revenue per user. This is where it gets interesting, right? So when you look at this is trailing 12 months, right, through the second quarter of 2018. So this is kind of astonishing. So if you look at rest of the world, so Facebook makes about $7 per user per year.
Mm-hmm.
In Asia, it's about $10 per user per year. in sort of consolidated worldwide, it's about $22 per user per year. In Europe, it's about $32 per user per year, and in North America, it's $97. Right, so you have this huge range. It's like 10x between North America and say Asia, and so let's think about Asia. It's by the way, Facebook users are predominantly outside of North America. It's like 89% outside of North America. It's still a vast majority. I think it's like 2/3 outside of North America and Europe. So you have a business that's, let's call it, levered to emerging market growth, and that those revenues per users, those revenues should grow at, call it, GDP plus inflation, if you did not have this tidal wave of dollars going from offline to online advertising.
Mm-hmm.
So Facebook's growth has been driven by the following. You have more users over time, and this is – I'm talking sort of backward looking. You've had growth in number of users. You've had growth in revenue per user, and that's a function of more advertisers going on the platform, more ad load. So you've had more advertisements shown on across Facebook's products. When you have more advertisers going into platform, you have the prices are set by auction, so you have more people bidding on these advertisements to target users, and so you get rising ad prices over time. And I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but I've seen this analysis where sort of the cost of advertisement on Facebook has been going up dramatically over time, and that's just a function of competition for users on – advertisers competing for users on the site.
Interesting.
Or on the platform. So you've had – and you have this tidal wave, right? Everybody knows that there is sort of a duopoly in digital advertising. It's Facebook and Google, and now you have the rise of Amazon with growing advertising revenues, because after all, sort of half of all product searches start on Amazon, not Google. So you have maybe a duopoly becoming an oligopoly with those three. But there is a secular shift from offline to online advertising. Like Facebook is sucking a lot of ad dollars out of print, out of traditional offline media, and some of it is out of home. Some of it, you know, TV dollars have been reasonably stable but are coming down. So that's been sort of backward looking. But what I did initially is I assumed a much, much lower growth rate going forward. And I assumed this is what the company generates in terms of free cash flow. These are the margins. This is the cash build. And so at what point, and then if I keep the price static, so right now the stock is trading at $159 as we speak, I keep the price static. And I look at the multiple, and so this year it's trading at, you know, this much, you know, 12 times EBITDA, and the next year it's 10 times, and then it's 9 times. And I got to a point where it was, you know, 1 times EBITDA. And I said, well, it's not going to trade at 1 times EBITDA. It's a reasonable multiple. And so you sort of back into a reasonably good estimate that this thing is mispriced.
Yeah.
So that's how I did it initially.
Interesting. So for investors looking at Facebook today, what would you say to focus on?
Well, so I think there's been so much happening this year that the headlines are scary, right? So you have obviously Cambridge Analytica happened this year, which was something that stemmed from decisions made many, many years ago. So it wasn't necessarily something that Facebook had under its control today. But then recently you had this actual breach. Cambridge Analytica wasn't really a breach. It was they allowed a researcher to conduct a poll on the site, a personality test, and then that researcher sold the data against the policies, right? So that research – and then he certified that he had deleted the data when he hadn't, so that, you know, committed fraud. Now you actually had a breach, and it's at least 50 million users who are affected. We don't really
including Mark's own account, which sounds really fucking bad.
Oh, I didn't know that his own account.
Yeah, his own account was under the breach.
Yeah.
That's not good.
Yeah. So, you know, look, you know, there have been so many breaches of data in the past several years that I'm not sure that there is a lot out there. Let's say I got breached, right? In this, I think it was Target, Equifax, Home Depot, the Government Office of Personnel Management. I can't remember the exact name of the government agency. There's been just a lot of data breaches recently. So yeah. I'm not sure that there's a lot of incremental information out there that wasn't already out there. So anyway.
I agree.
But it's not good. It's definitely not good. The one thing, though, is if you look at the actual and I always tell people, go back to the source documents. If you look at the blog post that Facebook had, they explained the vulnerability. It was actually an exploitation of several different pieces of code. It was actually pretty hard to create this breach. And so it was a very, very sophisticated attack. But again, it doesn't exonerate them, right? This is a very large multi-billion dollar company. They have to invest in safety and security, and they are investing in safety and security. And I do believe that they are conscientious about protecting the value of the franchise. Now, you know, their future management decisions will dictate whether this is a blip or a structural issue. You know, that remains to be seen.
Yeah. Interesting. Any other things regarding Facebook before we finish up?
Well, I think Facebook is, you know, is pretty has a lot of optionality in the sense that, you know, Instagram,
like new product, like Instagram market, that marketplace for Instagram, stuff like that.
Exactly. So
and whatever other products they'll come out with that we haven't even thought of yet or modeled into our valuation.
That's right. So you know, for example, if you look at monthly active users and daily active users, that does not include Instagram, WhatsApp, or Oculus. And they make that very clear in their quarterly filings. So now Instagram is becoming a more and more prominent part of Facebook. And I think that it has enormous opportunities. If they do it right, again, it's a big if, but if they do it right, there's a huge opportunity to turn Instagram into a huge e-commerce platform, because it's phenomenal for visual discovery. I don't know if you've ever seen these tagged products on Instagram.
I have, yeah. I've actually bought one or two as well, which I never have done on any. I've never purchased. So here's a fun fact, which I'm sure a lot of listeners out there can relate to. I've never purchased a product on, like, you know, one of the. You remember when you go on websites and there'd just be like a little pop up? I guess it still happens, but it doesn't seem as much anymore. But like, you'd have a pop up banner with some product and it would just always be obnoxious and scammy and you'd X out of it. You know what I'm talking about? So with Instagram, I find that there's products all the time that come up with like the ads and I'm like, oh, I could use that. Oh, wow. I didn't even know I could use that, but that's awesome that it even exists. And it's really amazing, the targeting. And I've actually made a purchase from an ad, I think twice before.
So that's interesting, Eric. So do you like targeted ads?
Sometimes I do, actually, because for me, this is actually an interesting conversation. So I've already thought about this, but for me, the experience of a targeted ad when it's well done is like, oh, wow, this is cool. They're helping me discover something that I actually could use and never thought about it before. Like, I'll give you an example. I've been working on my posture, and all of a sudden Instagram started, I don't know how the hell they targeted me on this, but I do know how they targeted me on this, but it seems like magic if you don't know the technology behind it. They started showing me these back, like these posture correctors that didn't look like you were in like a back brace or something. Cause I'm a pretty in shape dude. I don't need like a back brace and need to look handicapped, right? And I'm like, this is actually kind of cool. And they show someone like running in them and like, you know, like a bodybuilder using them. So I bought it. It wasn't that expensive. And my chiropractor was like, wow, your posture's gotten a lot better recently. I'm like, oh, I bought this thing I saw an ad on Instagram, like $12, and Like, so there's been things like that before where it was just like a little thing, and I was like, oh, that's cool. I didn't even know this existed. And yeah, so in those cases, I do like it because it's like technology helping me discover things that could add value to my life.
Yeah, that's a great point. I couldn't agree more. I absolutely hate when I rarely watch advertisements on TV. I rarely watch TV, I guess. But when I, you know, if there's like maybe sports, right, you can't get away from it. But it's painful to watch those ads that really have nothing to do with you. Like, why am I seeing like a tampon ad or like an Enbrel? I don't even know. It's like this drug that, you know.
Have you read The Power of Pull?
No, I haven't.
So it was a great book. It was a recommendation by actually someone else who was a guest on the show, John King, who invented the tribal leadership stuff, which I've shared with you about. So he always recommends amazing. Like, he's never recommended a book to me that I was like, oh, that was a waste of time. He's like one of those guys. So he recommended me a book years ago called Power of Pull. And in a nutshell, it goes into the dynamics and principles about how the world is moving away from these like push models and is more around things being pulled, like you pulling things towards you. So like an example would be like, you know, if a drug company is just like pushing out things to you that aren't relevant to you. And, you know, when you're watching TV commercials, you're having ads pushed at you. When you're doing sales and people make sales calls to you, that's like, you know, a way of push marketing, right? And then an example of pull would be like, they talk about, there's this one example in the book, I think I'm getting this right, where this guy won like a professional surfing competition. He either invented some move or did some move that was like deemed to be impossible. And he like learned it by like watching other surfers on YouTube. So essentially he was able to like pull and compile data to then actually implement something on his own, where it would have been impossible to do it with just like a surfing instructor, because you would have needed like thousands of different like examples and case studies and watching other people attempt to do the same thing so you could do this thing on your own. So the concept of advertising, where instead of, you know, people being obnoxious and pushing shit at you, it's like, wow, like this is the kind of stuff you're into, and you're essentially pulling stuff towards you that adds value to your life. Well, now all of a sudden you have marketing and advertising being something that isn't a dirty word anymore, but is there to serve the customer, which is probably originally what advertising was intended for, and it still helps, but it's less manipulative.
Yeah, and it's an interesting concept too, because the old adage was half of my advertising doesn't work, I just don't know which half.
Right, exactly, yeah.
If you can actually target better now, there's a lot less waste and you have much better outcomes and happier customers, right? I personally find the advertising on Instagram, you know, delightful, tell you the truth. I find it – I've had the same experience as you have. I've never bought anything yet, but I've gotten very close. And the products, I'm like, wow, this is something really cool, and I'm super happy that they showed this to me.
Yeah. You know what? I could do a whole episode or probably several episodes on this concept, because I can go so deep into it. But it's – I'm sure we can continue this conversation offline as well. But it's fascinating, and it's interesting to see that as – I'm going to open so many can of worms, it'll be uncomfortable if I just don't finish those thoughts, and then we'll have a 4-hour show. So I'm not going to go there for now.
Sounds good. Yeah. I like the idea though. Yeah.
Yeah. It's fast. It's what's really cool is I will say this, when you start seeing connections between how technology, productivity, the way that people connect with each other in relationship in groups all come together, it's one of those experiences, that is just as powerful as like when I learned about like margin of safety, intrinsic value, and Mr. Market. And then when you know those three things, it's like, boom, like, holy shit, like my mind just exploded. I just got it.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like a great pitch for Facebook, right? And something that, that Mark would approve of, the sort of this technology and people and society and community and all that.
Don't you understand? So, this is a job interview for Yahoo, for Facebook.
Yeah, so, you know,
Mark, if you're listening, call me.
Yeah. So now they have a, you know, company lieutenant, Adam Mosseri, in charge of Instagram. Yeah. Hopefully he takes this thing to new heights. There's also, of course, WhatsApp, right? As you know, they've been trying to grow their payments business in India. They've been stymied by the regulators.
Didn't the Instagram founders, though, didn't they just leave Facebook? I think I read that this week.
Yeah, exactly. So Kevin Systrom and I think the other founder, I forget his name, but they both left. And Adam Mosseri of Facebook is now in charge. Okay. And so hopefully,
how do you feel about that? Like, do you see that as a negative, or do you see that as like?
Look, I can argue both sides, right? So yeah. On the one hand, you had these guys who, I think Kara Swisher wrote a very good piece in the New York Times about this. I always like to read what she writes. She's very close to the company. She knows a lot of people inside Facebook, and she's always talking to insiders to get interesting perspectives. And on the one hand, you had folks who acted differently and had different beliefs from Mark Zuckerberg, and who were sort of product first and customer first, et cetera. Mark is much more of, let's say, a strategic, you know, let's build this, let's build a monetization engine, let's move fast type of guy. And so on the one hand, it's bad that they left because that original product vision is perhaps gone. On the other hand, it's good that they left because now product development can happen at a much faster pace, I think.
Yeah.
I hope. You know, when you look at – frankly, when you look at and I'm no expert in Chinese internet, but
– What? You're not?
From everything that I have, yeah, from everything that I have read and listened to, and everything from the people who are experts, we are sort of in the dark ages. When you compare any Western property to WeChat, which is like a super app, and other super apps in China, there is just so much more functionality that could be built into these products that we've barely scratched the surface.
Why do you think is that a regulatory thing or a cultural thing, or is it both?
I don't think it's regulatory. It might be a combination of cultural and also the other thing is, remember, in Asia, there was not a lot of infrastructure that you had to overcome to get some of these things going. So, for example, you had the rise of Alipay and WeChat Pay, and this is peer-to-peer payments, because there was not an existing sort of hundreds of millions of users of credit cards.
That makes sense.
Right. When you have credit cards, it's very hard to change the habit. And also, it's very hard to come up with something that's so much easier and so much better that it becomes very compelling. And there's also a huge network effect in credit cards.
I love
everybody has them.
Venmo is bomb. Have you ever used Venmo?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, again, how do you bootstrap the network, right? How do you get the network effect going so that every merchant in the U.S. accepts Venmo, and every user has Venmo and knows how to use it and is aware of it. So that's a problem that the network that the credit card companies have already solved in the West.
Wouldn't you think that? So I don't know the answer to this question. Maybe you do, but like, why didn't Visa or MasterCard invent Venmo themselves or buy Venmo?
Well,
because you take away an extra step by doing that.
Probably it's the classic innovator's dilemma. Right. I don't have a great answer, but it's probably a classic innovator's dilemma. So you have a case of a market that does not yet exist, that is too small to analyze, and you have a product that is disruptive because it's free and it cannibalizes your core offering. So no way, right?
Well, I don't necessarily know if it cannibalizes. I think it adds to it. Just, right? I mean, like I still use my card, but if I want to give money to someone real quick, I can literally give it to them in 10 seconds and it instantly goes there if they pay that 25 cent fee.
Yep.
Which is unbelievable.
It's incredible.
And totally worth 25 cents to pay that.
Yep. Yeah. So you're seeing, that's it in the West, right? And then we'll see how far this goes. And WhatsApp has a huge opportunity to create perhaps new payment methods or adopt an existing payment method. And they're trying. They're trying, especially in India. So that's another under-monetized property, and I think a product that has been pretty stagnant for the past several years. You haven't seen a lot of new features in WhatsApp. And those founders also left earlier in the year, so now they can accelerate that.
Interesting.
And then the last piece, of course, is Oculus, right?
Yeah.
Which nobody ever talks about because, you know, Oculus is virtual reality, and who uses virtual reality? Nobody.
A lot of people will in the future.
Yeah, so
it's gonna be a big deal.
I think, you know, Michael Abrash gave a phenomenal keynote last week at the Oculus event, and I thought it was very compelling because he makes this analogy to Xerox PARC in the late 70s, in 1979, I think, and Steve Jobs went there. And Steve Jobs says, look, you know, within 10 minutes, it was so obvious to me that this graphical user interface was the future. You could argue on who the winners were going to be and how long it was going to take, et cetera, but you could not argue that this was absolutely inevitable. And so Mike Abrash said, look, you know, let's assume that there is a socially acceptable, lightweight, very, very, you know, something that looks like your eyeglasses, but that gives you – that overlays onto your environment extremely high resolution, essentially retina resolution. A phone, your computer, your TV has a context-aware assistant in your ear, right? So you, last time we were talking about Alexa everywhere, so maybe this is another type of assistant, or maybe it's Alexa everywhere with you. And essentially it substitutes your PC, your iPhone, your television, and you can do all sorts of things in this device. We would all be wearing it. He makes a very compelling case that this is about 4 to 5 years away.
Well, have you listened or read any of Ray Kurzweil's work?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think his stuff is fascinating. And it plays a lot into all of what we're talking about right now.
Exactly. You know, Ray Kurzweil has been a very successful forecaster of technology because he's been looking at these curves, and he understands Moore's law and learning curves and how things get cheaper and better over time. And Mike Abrash is doing a very similar calculation across, and it's very complicated technology. You've got to get so many different pieces of the puzzle right to get that very lightweight device on your face that does all these things. But he goes through the math and the numbers, and it makes sense.
Is there a link to that talk somewhere online? Was it recorded?
Yeah. So there's a.
Do you have it? Could you send it to me, and I could put it in the show notes when we're done?
Yeah, sure. So I wrote a blog post about it actually. And
let's do that. Yeah, that'd be great. And anything that you have for me, please email me, and it's good to have in the notes.
For sure.
Cool. Anything else regarding Facebook that you'd like to talk about?
Well, I guess that's it. I guess this is another one where in a year, you know, there's going to be a lot more to talk about, and hopefully they can figure out a lot of this manipulation of elections and security issues and all that, and we move on to talking about the business next year.
Yeah, it'd be cool. All right, Marcelo, thanks a lot. Have a great day.
Thank you, Eric. You too.
Yeah, take care.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast with Eric Schlein. If you'd like to connect with Eric for questions, comments, feedback, ideas, or to inquire about being on the show, please contact Eric at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. So, in the words of Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.